You can subscribe to The Spectator for 12 weeks for only £12 for our print and online editions, plus get 6 months of digital access free to The Telegraph. Go to spectator.co.uk/telegraph.
Hello, and welcome to Spectator's Book Club podcast. I'm Sam Leith, the literary editor of The Spectator, and this week I'm joined by the aviation historian Roland White, whose new book, Harrier 809, Britain's Legendary Jump Jet and the Untold Story of the Falklands War, comes out in October. I'm also very pleased to be joined by one of the men without whom this book and the Falklands War would not have been possible, Commander Tim Gedge, who was the CO of 809 Naval Air Squadron, one of the three squadrons of Harriers dispatched to the Falklands in the early 80s. Welcome both.
Thanks, Sam. Lovely to be joining you.
And likewise from me.
Now, Roland, if I may start just by asking you, how did the sort of book begin to come together? The Falklands is a subject that's been gone over quite a lot by historians in the last sort of 30 years. What was it that convinced you there was a new story to be told here, and what got you excited about it?
Well, I mean, the Falklands War first captured my imagination as an 11-year-old boy, as it did for so many of my generation. And I knew through that interest that there'd been two very, very good accounts of the Sea Harrier's War in the Falklands written in the form of Sharkey Ward's Sea Harrier Over the Falklands and Dave Morgan's Hostile Skies, both of which are about the two different squadrons, frontline squadrons, that went down with the carriers initially. But I was also aware that alongside that, there was a, in some ways, a more unusual, more intriguing story of 809 Squadron, a third frontline squadron that was commissioned after the invasion, hastily pulled together using men and machines from all over the country, indeed all over the world, some of whom were then deployed less than 3 weeks later with fewer than 10 hours time in the cockpit of a Sea Harrier. So it had a sort of Dirty Dozen feel to it. We're going to pull this team together and send them on a special mission. And indeed, one of the veterans that I spoke to who helped train 809, reflecting on that, said, you know, the only person we didn't have was anybody out of jail.
Now, sort of much of the first part of the book describes that kind of pulling it together aspect. And it's kind of remarkable, you know, to those of us who tend to think, or imagine at least, that, you know, army and navy and military logistics are these sort of seamless things where you know exactly where all your planes are and they're all ready to go and they're all stored here. But you're sort of running around, where are the pilots? Oh, half of them are in America, half of them are here, half of them, you know. I mean, Tim, you were doing that pulling together. You know, can you talk us through a bit the beginning of this story, you know, when you first knew, you know, as it were, that the balloon had gone up?
Yeah, it was a very extraordinary time. I had had the privilege of bringing the first frontline Sea Harrier squadron into service at the beginning of 1980. I'd had command of that for a couple of years and had only just in the early part of 82 handed over command of 800 Squadron, as it was. When the Argentines invaded, I was sort of kicking my heels on the Admiral's staff in Portsmouth, very much in a desk job, sort of organising the people to go south. And actually, I have to say that I was, put it mildly, upset that all my team were going to go off and fight a war, and I was the one person who was going to be left behind. So I was very, very pleased as the day that the ship sailed, that the Admiral rang me up and said, would I come back to Yeovilton and form a new squadron with the sort of remnants and bring it together and go south? So that was a real challenge in a sense, but I had an awful lot to build it from. I mean, I brought 800 Squadron into service. That was a new squadron forming. It wasn't, as it were, taking over a squadron. So I'd done all the sort of preparation. I knew exactly what I wanted to do. I mean, the problem was that we only had 21 days to do it in. And so thinking of, I went straight back to Yeovilton and got stuck in. And I've said several times that one of the most difficult things was thinking what it was that we wanted. I mean, the whole sort of supply organisation, the whole of the country was actually producing exactly what it was we wanted. the difficult thing, in a sense, was thinking outside the box and thinking what it was that we did want. And I saw that very much as my job at Yeovilton.
There's remarkable stuff in here about how, for instance, a sort of 8 or 9 month training course, you know, you were thinking of ways of kind of sandwiching it into 3 weeks. And, you know, we have descriptions of people who've never landed a Sea Harrier at sea. You know, the first time they actually do it is in theatre. I mean, is that the sort of thing that could still be done today?
Well, I think, yes, it is. I mean, given that somebody can fly the aeroplane and can take it off and land it and fight it, then landing on a ship is, with a short takeoff, vertical landing, a STOVL aircraft, is not actually colossally difficult. If you can do it on a runway ashore, do a vertical landing. If particularly if you can land on a pad ashore, then landing on the deck of a carrier is not hugely difficult. Doing it at night is a slightly different matter, but if the deck is moving a lot, it gets more difficult. But the basic operation is relatively simple. Now, if you look to the sort of the new generation of the F-35B, which we've got at sea, yes, if people can land that ashore, they would be able to land it on the ship.
And yet, Tim, I love the story that you shared with me of how you were trying to prepare your squadron to land on Atlantic Conveyor, that had an unusual feature in this mast that it had right next to the landing pad. And you hired a crane, I think, and dragged this poor driver to Yeovilton to pretend to be Atlantic Conveyor.
That was, yes. And fortunately, when I was on board Atlantic Conveyor and we were busy sort of removing the tie-down points for the containers and all sorts of other things on the deck to actually take the aircraft, there was a strong body of engineers and the dockyard people there who wanted to take away the foremast, the forward mast in Atlantic Conveyor, because they thought it would get in the way of people landing. Fortunately, I was there and I said, no, for goodness sake, you've got to leave that, because that's the only reference point we're going to have. And if you think about sort of landing on a pad ashore, what you do, because you can't see below you in a Sea Harrier when you're landing, you look out to the side, and normally a couple of large poles are put out ahead of the aircraft and out at the side of the aircraft, and you line these up, one with the other, and then come down, keeping them in line. But of course you can't do that at sea. I mean, everything is, you know, you can't, because in the middle of the ocean. So it seemed to me that the only way we were going to actually position ourselves was by formating, as it were, at the top of the mast and then coming down. The fact that the mast was pointing 10 degrees off the vertical seemed to me not to be a problem. But the only way to try it, occurred to me as I was driving back to Yeovilton, was to actually get a crane and incline the mast, which is exactly what we did.
To frame the story a little in perspective, and maybe Roland, this would be one for you. You know, what was the sort of position of the Navy when the Falklands kicked off? You know, because it was just, I mean, as you say, somewhere early on, it seemed to be, you know, this was the perfect opportunity to demonstrate why we needed a Navy. Almost the only one you could have thought of.
I mean, Tim will be able to expand on this, I'm sure. But the impression I got from talking to people was that the Navy in early 1982, for all that it was looking forward to continuing to develop the capability of the Sea Harrier and the CVS ships, Invincible, Lustrous and Ark Royal, was also in the throes of its reaction to John Nott's proposed cuts to the fleet. And that included the selling of HMS Invincible to the Australian Navy. So it was an organisation that was definitely feeling under the cosh, kind of under threat, a little underappreciated. And when I'd spotted a quote from Dennis Healey, one of the things he was well known for as Defence Secretary was abandoning plans for a replacement for previous generation of aircraft carrier, Ark Royal. said when the Navy was making its case for a new generation of carriers, the one scenario that nobody ever put in front of him, although there were plenty of imaginative scenarios, was an effort to recapture the Falkland Islands after an invasion. But it just so happened that of all the scenarios that the Navy might have encountered that would demonstrate the value of the aircraft carriers, demonstrate the value of being able to operate 8,000 miles from home at the end of a long supply line, Falkland Islands was almost perfectly designed to be able to do that, while at the same time, to a very large extent, excluding the Royal Air Force from being able to contribute in the way that they might have been able to had it been closer to home.
Now, we only had these two big carriers, Hermes and Invincible. And as you say, Invincible was about to be sold off. If the Argentinians had invaded the Falklands, say, a year later, would Invincible have been in Australia and the repossession of the Falklands have been impossible?
Well, we'd have had a lustrous by then. So we would, had we still had Hermes, who was eventually sold to India. Although, actually, Argentina asked if she could buy Hermes in the 60s. And I think that there was even talk of selling Hermes to Chile as well. But illustrious was actually rushed into to service very, very quickly after the invasion. And in fact, Tim took 809 south on illustrious in July, after the end of the war, to go and provide air defence for the islands before the runway was extended. So, you know, a year later, you know, yes, probably we'd have been in a position to fight a similar war.
Okay, well, that's a sort of relief. Now, obviously, the star of the story is the Sea Harrier. And Tim, tell us a little about this aeroplane. What's it like to fly?
Well, it's a typical Hawker aeroplane, so it's a wonderful, lovely aeroplane to fly. It does everything that a pilot would want, and it has this astonishing ability to be able to take off and particularly to land vertically. So, in a sense, you've got an aircraft which is as nice an aeroplane to fly as a Hunter, for instance. It comes out of the same stable. But it has, as I've said, this astonishing ability to land vertically. And if you look at the way that the sort of the whole concept of bringing it into service was thought up, it was done on a shoestring. It was, if you go back to the sort of defence decisions that were made, everything was based around the NATO areas. In other words, it was all north of the equator, and it was based fundamentally around the North Atlantic. So the idea that the Royal Navy would have to go and do something in sort of far-flung and away from land-based aircraft was, although a lot of us who were involved thought that we would be somewhat vulnerable, we were not allowed to really voice that because everything was costed on the NATO. And of course, if you look at the ability, the Royal Air Force said that they would be able to provide fighter protection for the fleet wherever, and also that they would particularly provide airborne early warning. And there were some misgivings about this, but the basis of the Harrier was to, Sea Harrier, was to have something that could react very quickly if a sort of last-ditch defence of the fleet was needed before the Royal Air Force land-based fighters could actually make it out there. So that was the sort of fundamental reasons for bringing the Sea Harrier into service. It really was not envisaged to provide the sort of air defence of the fleet that we used it for in the Falklands. And of course, the one thing we particularly missed was the airborne early warning. And of course, loss of HMS Sheffield and other ships down there was a direct result of, and Atlantic Conveyor for that matter, was a direct result of not having the airborne early warning capability.
And what were you facing in terms of the Argentinian Air Force? I know, Roland, you got some remarkable cooperation and help, judging by your acknowledgements and judging by the detail in the book, from Argentinian air defence and aviation historians who gave you a sense of what was going on their side.
Yes, I mean, the one thing which, and I must admit to standing on the shoulders of previous generations of historians as well, who conducted extensive interviews with Argentine flyers after the war, some of which are now in the National Archives. So I first of all realised that since the archives around the Falklands War had been declassified under the 30-year rule, nobody had really used them or drawn on the information in them to write about the air war in the Falklands. And so that was another reason for wanting to get stuck into this story again. But the thing that came across incredibly powerfully was just how committed, professional, skillful, and actually reasonably well equipped the Argentine Air Force and Naval Air Arm were. The idea that we were sort of fighting some third world country that wasn't in a position to sort of compete in a near peer war would have been entirely to misunderstand the situation. Certainly, and Tim's talked about NATO, they had fewer opportunities to train against equivalent air arms. But we shouldn't underestimate at all the size of the task that faced what initially were just 20 Sea Harriers. And Tim's boss, who was the admiral in charge of aircraft carriers and amphibious ships, produced a report as Invincible and Hermes were sailing south that suggested that it was entirely possible that within a week's worth of fighting, due to both combat losses and the effects of unserviceability on that small force of 20 Sea Harriers, that we might be down to just 10 left fighting by the end of week one. And so Tim's effort to produce as quickly as possible a meaningful reinforcement and attrition replacements for that tiny force that were facing this large, 10 times larger, very capable collection of Argentinian pilots and relatively modern fast jet fighters was absolutely crucial.
Yeah. How important overall were the Sea Harriers to the Falklands War effort?
Without the Sea Harrier and the ability to provide some sort of defence of the amphibious operations area, for instance, let alone air defence of the fleet, we would not have won. So I think it was absolutely essential to winning the war. Now, that's not saying the Sea Harrier won the war, of course, because there were all sorts of other essential elements of it, but it was part of the mix of capabilities that we had, which were essential to winning.
And that mix of capabilities, there's a wonderful phrase, I don't know whose it is, but Roland, you pull it out. You say that the Harrier is capable of, you know, winning a knife fight in a phone box.
One does stumble across these incredible phrases, particularly when start sort of looking at what the US Marine Corps used to say about the Harrier. And they were very early supporters of the Harrier program, late 60s and early 70s. And the Harrier, because of its unique capabilities, was one of really just two foreign aeroplanes, British aeroplanes, that were ever made such a compelling case, were bought by the American armed forces. One of them was the Canberra bomber and reconnaissance plane, and the other was the Harrier, because the Marines felt that it was exactly what they needed to fight something like the war they fought in the Pacific at the end of the Second World War. And it was the US Marine Corps who first explored and appreciated the unique potential of the Harrier as a dogfighting machine, because it had these, in order to be able to take off and land vertically, rotating nozzles that could direct the power of the jet engine. And if you were to use these in forward flight, vectoring in forward flight, you were able to change direction or decelerate at an extraordinary rate, which no normal fixed wing fast jet could possibly compete with. And so, you know, everything that the US Marine Corps and subsequently the Royal Air Force and Royal Navy put the Harrier and Sea Harrier up against often came away with egg on its face. And I know Tim can tell you about the occasion when he, with 800 Squadron, first encountered what was the sort of supposedly the epitome of the fourth generation of dogfighting machines, the F-16, American F-16. I think, was it Lucas or Lossiemouth up in Scotland?
I think it's worth saying at this stage that I had the huge advantage over the Argentines that I had fought practice exercises the Sea Harrier against virtually every aircraft in the Western world, actually with the exception of the Mirage 3 and the Super 8 on that. But we'd fought against a full range of American aircraft on much of that practice fighting on instrumented ranges. So we had a lot of our pilots had flown the F-4 Phantom operationally in previous appointments. So we had a lot of knowledge about what the other aircraft could do. And particularly, we knew what the Sea Harrier could not do, which is hugely important in any sort of air combat. The Sea Harrier was a very simple aircraft with just a couple of heat-seeking missiles and a couple of guns. So it was limited in some ways, but that was, in a sense, one of its great strengths. The other point I think it's worth making is that had we not had the Sea Harrier in the sort of weather conditions that there were in the South Atlantic, then a lot of the time we would not have been able to fly. And the deck movements were way, way, way out of limits, the normal limits for flying aircraft. Even the sort of biggest of the American carriers, Nimitz class, would have had problems down there in those sort of conditions. But we could operate the Sea Harrier almost with impunity. And if the deck was moving, you simply hovered over the deck and waited for the deck to stop moving and then land and then tie the aircraft down. And that's a very important point, because we were reacting to Argentine attacks all the time. We were not attacking Argentina. So the Argentines could fly when the weather was suitable. We were flying whenever we were being attacked, and that was a very different thing. So I have said to a lot of people, without that ability, we would not have won the war. And those same people, particularly people in North America, have said to me many times that wouldn't you have loved to have had the old Ark Royal with Phantoms and Buccaneers, or, you know, one of their carriers with conventional aircraft? And my answer would have been yes in some ways, but no, if we'd had that, only that, we would have lost.
Now, the experience in battle, and, you know, when you went down to the Falklands, presumably you had an idea what your Harriers were going to have to do. Did what actually happened in the event correspond with that idea? I mean, was there, you know, as much dogfighting as you thought, or were there other roles the planes were playing that you hadn't expected?
When we set off, the intelligence advice that we had was pretty abysmal, to be quite honest. We had no detailed knowledge of the capability of the Argentine Air Force or the Navy pilots. We knew roughly how many aircraft they had, but that was sort of published in Jane's All the World's Aircraft. So that was very public knowledge. But really the detailed knowledge which we would have expected to have had, which we had, for instance, on all the Russian capabilities, we simply did not have against Argentina. So we were expecting something like 10 aircraft. I mean, they had about 200 combat aircraft, and we had 20. So, you know, you've got a sort of, 10-to-1 ratio against you. The expectation was that we were going to have a real problem. Now, in the event, as soon as the sort of first combat engagements were fought, we realised that actually the Argentines were not doing what we would have expected a well-trained fighter pilot to do. And they lost, aircraft. They were shot down. And at the end of the day, we shot down 23 of their aircraft to zero losses of our own. So as every day went by, I think we were greatly reassured that actually our capability was what we expected. And their capability, to be quite frank, was not up to the mark. I think they thought they were better than they were, and they hadn't had this benefit of training against other aircraft types on instrumented ranges, which was, to me, was absolutely invaluable.
There's also extraordinary detail, I think, early on in the book where you talk about the Argentine Air Force, and they're going through their kind of fighter jets, and they discover that the ejector seats don't work, and that half of them have cracks in the wings and so forth.
Well, that's right. That's actually the naval air arm, the small Argentine naval air arm that operated off the carrier the 25th of May. And indeed, they found out that all the ejector seat cartridges were well past their sell-by date. They weren't able to replace them, so they just had to create a new arbitrary used by date. And similarly, they found cracks in the wings, which they again had to make a decision about whether or not they were going to ignore and take those jets into combat in any case. And in fact, it did lead to the tragic death of one of the Argentine pilots who had safely made his way back to base after an aborted bombing raid. Was still carrying all the bombs under the wings, but because of the weight of that and a burst tire, veered off the runway, tried to eject, was unable to, was dragged out of the cockpit by his parachute, and the chair then landed heavily on top of him and killed him. And that was an entirely avoidable death as a result of the age and poor condition of the machine that he was forced to fly.
And I bet they found that pretty depressing. Certainly I would have done.
Well, there was the other Argentine pilot who was sort of hit by a Harrier quite early in the war, who then was returning. He tried to come down in Port Stanley, didn't he? And got shot down by his own anti-aircraft.
He did. I mean, that's very, very early on in the war when I think that there was... obviously enormous nervousness amongst the gunners around Stanley, and despite his best efforts to ensure that he was identified, there were gunners who were more concerned about making sure they shot down anything that was approaching. I think that the trigger for that was when he, in order to give himself a better chance of landing on a very short runway at Stanley, dropped his auxiliary fuel tanks from under the wings, and they thought that they were bombs and that they were being attacked, and that was when they opened fire. But again, a terrible accident.
Now, one of the enduringly sort of controversial moments of the war, of course, was the sinking of the Belgrano, which was nothing to do with the Harriers. It was a submarine that sank the Belgrano. But leaving aside the sort of, ethical rules of war questions that have dogged it, I was very interested to read the tactical effect of that, as you describe in the book.
Yeah, well, I mean, the reasons for the attack on the Belgrano have been sort of well rehearsed. But one of the things that had spurred the attack was the thought that the British fleet was going to be caught in a pincer movement from between Belgrano coming in from the south and an Argentine aircraft carrier led group from the north. But the sinking of the Belgrano, as indeed was predicted by the first Sea Lord, Sir Henry Leach, had the effect of removing the Argentine fleet from the subsequent fight, because it was demonstrable that they were extremely vulnerable to attack by submarine. And indeed, HMS Splendid, for a while, had the Argentine carrier in her sights, and I think only badly timed fog from the point of view of the captain of Splendid saved the carrier from being torpedoed. The Argentine admirals just sailed really only within territorial waters after that. That was as a direct result of the sinking of the Belgrano. So at a stroke, that attack removed a vital part of the Argentine arsenal from the war that followed and really isolated the islands, meaning that providing the Sea Harriers that were also able to do their job defending the British fleet and defending the amphibious assault against the islands, they were going to have to rely beyond that point on the defences and the resources that were on the islands themselves, because only the occasional transport plane coming into the islands could resupply them, and that wasn't going to be able to keep them going indefinitely.
Yes, he also said it took the Seahawks out of the equation.
The Argentine naval Skyhawk pilots had been excited about the prospect of what they imagined was going to be something like a sort of mini Battle of Midway in the South Atlantic, i.e. a carrier-on-carrier battle. And the removal of the carrier removed that prospect. But what it also did was ensure that there was a little bit, and Tim can reflect on this, I suspect, with far more insight. It meant that there was a greater degree of certainty or confidence about the direction from which the British ships might be attacked, because it was known from that point that they were only going to be able to attack from mainland bases, and they were always going to be to the west of the British carriers. The only, and this was critical subsequently to the fate of Atlantic Conveyor, only the Argentines' ability to refuel their attack jets in flight meant that actually the possibility of being attacked from unexpected directions remained, and that was crucial in what happened to Atlantic Conveyor and also in subsequent attacks against the British carriers.
Tim, can you have a sense of what, because I know that the early sort of infrastructure attacking raids on the islands themselves, which Sea Harriers were involved in, there's an amazing description of them flying between 5 and 15 feet above the ground as they came in. That was just a bit before you showed up. What was 809's main role once you arrived?
We were almost entirely on air defence of the amphibious operations area, the San Carlos area, and so we were manning combat air patrol stations generally to the west of San Carlos. There were some attack missions, but they were fairly limited by the time I'd got down there.
Although I remember, Tim, you telling me on one occasion, and you know, certainly there were ships still being sunk after the time that 809 joined the fight, because that was prior to the amphibious landings. Remember you telling me about an occasion when you and your wingman were being vectored onto an Argentine attack against the ships, and that the rule was that you couldn't enter the missile engagement zone of the British ships for fear that you yourself would then become a target of those missiles, and that you were sort of hot pursuit of the Argentine Skyhawks when, you know, much to your chagrin, you're hauled off and told that the ship's missiles were going to take them instead.
Yeah, that was HMS Coventry, and we had a couple of Skyhawks, or four Skyhawks ahead of us, and I reckon that had we not been hauled off, then we might have got missiles amongst those attacking aircraft before they actually released their bombs. But that would have gone totally against all the normal rules that we operated to. So there was a sort of anything outside 15 miles from the ship at that stage was we could attack aircraft. Between 10 and 15 miles was a sort of crossover zone, and anything inside 10 miles would have been, as we called it, take it with birds. The ship would have taken out the attacking aircraft. So it was a classic case. It was absolutely in accordance with the rule book. We were hauled off, and sadly, the ship's defence armament didn't take out the attacking aircraft.
Tim, what's your most enduring memory of your experience in theatre?
Gosh, that's an interesting question. In a sense, one of relief that everything worked as we expected it to work. Serviceability of the aircraft was virtually 100%. I mean, what I'm saying is that every time we planned to fly a mission, the aircraft was there, ready, waiting, and it worked as advertised. So I think my overriding, looking back on it, was that we were very lucky in a sense that we had the practice, and from my own point of view, for the 2 years prior to the conflict, we knew what we were doing, we knew the aircraft, we knew what we could not do with the aircraft, which is almost as important as knowing what you can do. And my other thought is that the enemy, the Argentine Air Force and Navy, were not actually operating really fully to the way that I would have expected. And I think in that respect, we were lucky that they had not had the practice and the training that they might have had.
Now, they didn't shoot down, as you say, any of the British Sea Harriers, but we did lose men and planes in the course of the conflict, didn't we?
Yes, we lost a couple to one on an attack on Goose Green was shot down by the ground-based anti-aircraft fire. And
this is Nick Taylor.
Nick Taylor, and also one was shot down by a Roland missile over Stanley. But the other losses were really due to the weather. So they were accidents. I think go back on, to what I was saying earlier was that the weather conditions at times were simply appalling, and in normal course of aircraft operations at sea, you would not dream of flying, but we had to fly. So the aircraft was capable of it. I think in a way perhaps we were lucky we didn't lose more aircraft to accidents, but that was a fact. The weather at times was not good.
Nick Taylor, who was this person you mentioned, who was shot down when approaching Goose Green, there's a detail in the book which I don't know enough about military technology to have completely deciphered, but you said that he didn't know he was going to be fired on by these anti-aircraft guns because they'd reconfigured the Harrier in some way. They'd removed something called the RWR. Was that a mistake?
My understanding of that particular shooting down was that it was not the radar-aimed gun, but it was visually laid. So he was the number three in the three attacking aircraft. My understanding was that it was the chap manning the gun who actually visually sighted the aircraft coming in and visually aimed the gun at it. So whether had he had a radar warning receiver, then I suppose that might have alerted him. But actually, when you're attacking something, you don't jink around. You keep going in a straight line because you want the weapon to go where you're aiming it. I'm not sure that the lack of an RWR really would have made that much difference, to be quite honest. And the other point on the radar warning was that there was a lot of sort of spurious noises that came out of it. So sometimes the spurious noises were so off-putting that I remember turning the whole system off in the aircraft from time to time. It drowned out everything else. I mean, that was a personal thing, but it was early days for the RWR. It later generations are vastly better.
There was another interesting aspect to that story, though, and one which may have had some sort of unintended or unexpected consequences and further persuaded the Argentine Navy to stay inshore. In that the jet that Nick Taylor was flying had been a jet used for trials at Dunsfold, which was where the Harriers were made. It was being used for trialing a new Exocet type anti-ship missile called the Sea Eagle. And it had, as Tim says, had the RWR, the radar warning receiver, removed so that the trials kit for that Sea Eagle missile could be installed in its place. And so when the Argentines went through the wreckage of Nick Taylor's jet, they found all the instrumentation for the Sea Eagle missiles and might well have come to the conclusion as a result that the British Sea Harriers were using those missiles and had a capability available to them that they actually in real life did not have. But that psychological concern, or that concern about a perceived capability, was really, really critical, because the Argentines, after the very first interception of one of their aircraft by a Royal Navy pilot called Simon Hargreaves as the fleet was sailing south, knew that the British had an advanced version of the Sidewinder missile called the AIM-9L, the 9 Lima. And this was much more capable than previous generation. In fact, the designers who came up with it labelled it the death ray. It was so unerring in its ability to hit its target from any angle. The Argentine pilots knew that the British had this 9 Lima missile and were very wary of it as a consequence, and perhaps reluctant to tangle with the Sea Harriers and instead just simply turn round and abandon a prospective raid because of the thought that they might be shot down if they were intercepted by the Sea Harriers. So psychological deterrent effect of sort of a perceived capability can be really critical and have a dramatic effect on the outcome of a battle. And a deterrent, turning away a raid without having shot it down, has exactly the same effect on the safety of the ships that had been the target as shooting down that aircraft.
Funny, Roland, you say early on that some of the stuff you came on was still classified.
This was what I'd originally intended to write, quite a focused and relatively short account of 809's war without bringing in many of the sort of wider aspects to it. But as soon as I got into the archives and realised that they hadn't really been explored since they'd been declassified, I realised there was a much broader tapestry to be woven, and the whole thing started to turn into something more like a sort of Tom Clancy novel. And 809's story became part of a wider attempt to tell the story of the critical effort to keep those carriers safe from attack. And those efforts were taking place at sea, 809's effort alongside the other Harrier squadrons, 800, 801, back at home, where establishments like the Royal Radar Establishment, Department of Naval Air Warfare, the Royal Air Force, Farnborough, Boscombe Down, etc., etc., all scrambling to come up with new capabilities, not least that develop an airborne early warning system, which they even considered putting inside an airship. But also the war that was going on the South American mainland to try to provide early warning of attack against the fleet. So, you know, I came across an attempt to use or an operation called Operation Folklore to deploy Canberra PR9 spy planes to Chile and land them on the Pan American Highway before sending them down to Punta Arenas to flying a Nimrod spy plane off a sort of remote Pacific island called San Felix, which almost on two occasions ended in disaster. And also the deployment of a small signals outfit to Santiago to relay radar imagery or radar information gleaned from the Argentinian bases by satellite link from Santiago and the headquarters of the Chilean Air Force intelligence operation back to Northwood where the war was being run from, and to the fleet as well. So I think that was Operation Shutter, and those reports were reaching the carrier too. So the whole thing became this sort of, so say, like a kind of Tom Clancy thriller, as I was trying to weave together all these different elements to, in the service of this effort to keep the carriers safe.
There was a remarkable detail in the Chilean aspect of the story, whereby they, you know, your sort of diplomat, come naval attaché, come spy kind of character who's down there, says to the Chilean senior officer, says, look, we'd really like to fly these Canberras out. And he said, oh, we can't possibly do that. It's too recognisable an aircraft. You know, they'll know you're doing this. So you simply have to sell us a couple in training.
Yeah, that's right. And perhaps once you've sold them to us, you could send maybe a couple of instructors down to help us sort of bring them into service. And, you know, were some of those training flights to possibly take pictures of the Argentinian ships and the disposition of their forces? Well, you know, that would be an acceptable side effect, perhaps. But, you know, that the Chileans were, you know, incredibly supportive and helpful of the British effort. But, you know, perhaps up until the time that the Daily Star reported that there was a squadron of Phantoms in Tierra del Fuego ready to shoot the Argentinian Air Force out of the sky, which was entirely false. But they did kind of get cold feet about the amount of publicity that seemed to be attracting British sort of under-the-radar efforts were starting to attract. And that I think, was eventually and fatally compounded when a burnt-out Seeking helicopter was found in Chile that had been used as a vehicle for an SAS reconnaissance of the Argentinian airfields. At that point, they said, OK, enough is enough. We're going to get ourselves... Because essentially, they were a neutral country, and they shouldn't have been providing any help whatsoever. And once they'd passed the point of plausible deniability, they sort of pulled up the drawbridge.
Do you think Mrs. Thatcher's enduring enthusiasm for Pinochet comes down in part to owing him one for that?
Yeah, I'm certain that it does, yes.
And I think if I could just add that I do think that one of the major features of your book, Roland, is the fact that you have, it's the first time that all the different threads of what was going on have been brought together. I mean, there have been books about how the Sea Harrier won the war, for instance, and Special Forces have produced books about how the Special Forces won the war. There have been other books about surface ships and so on, how they won the war. But actually, it was this combination of all the capabilities that won. It was not one single element of it. And I think the Harrier 809 actually does bring this all together in quite a vivid way. I think the book is going to be very well received by all sorts of people.
Oh, that's very, very kind of you, Tim. I mean, I think that was the thing that struck me as I got further and further into the book was kind of the depth and breadth of the way that, Britain fought the war. You know, there were the sort of headline stories as the war unfolded, and they have tended to remain foremost in people's minds. But there was so much going on beneath the surface, and I mean that sort of metaphorically. There was so much going on that was unknown to people, and yet fascinating and dramatic and exciting and urgent in its own right. And all of those different elements, whether they were industry and British aerospace, whether it was the planners at Northwood, or the efforts of Department of Naval Air Warfare to generate greater capability for the Sea Harrier, or indeed the Royal Air Force's extraordinary efforts in almost providing a pipeline of new Harriers that could be delivered to the carriers kind of as required, were incredible. And the logistics operation of the Falklands War is just staggering. Very few countries could conceivably have mounted an operation like that. In fact, I suspect that 1982, it was probably just two, and that was Britain and the United States.
Last question, I'm afraid we're running out of time, but Tim, I just wanted to ask, when you saw the Sea Harriers go out of service, did you sort of, as it were, shed a tear? Do you feel a sentimental attachment to the plane, or is it just a piece of machinery?
Many tears. I think what a crass decision it was. 2010, well, we lost the Sea Harrier in 06, but to take away the Harrier capability when we did was quite astonishing. It was such a cost-effective and capable aircraft. And from the Royal Navy's point of view, it's taking over 10 years to get back into the idea of capability of operating a carrier. And now we're seeing with the new two new carriers, of course, we've got this fantastic capability with the F-35, carriers that can actually take pretty well any airplane, new helicopter or capability you want to put on board. So, but yes, when the Harrier went, I was particularly upset.
Well, anybody who loves Harriers can revisit their glory days in this great book. Roland White and Tim Gedge, I'm very grateful for your time. Thank you.
You can subscribe to The Spectator for 12 weeks for only £12 for our print and online editions, plus get 6 months of digital access free to The Telegraph. Go to spectator.co.uk/telegraph.